Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Monday, April 27th, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government and opening a hearing on House Bill 5041 related to the Treasurer of the State. Mr. Borden.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. Before you is House Bill 5041, the primary budget bill of the State Treasury. The governor's budget for the bill is $57.3 million other funds and 114 positions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Treasurer, Mr. Bond, Mr. Hara. No, not Mr. Hara. Mr. Reinhart coming?
Not.
Excuse me?
Hopefully not. Hopefully we'll handle it.
Okay. Have at it, gentlemen.
Thank you. Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Ted Wheeler. I'm the treasurer. You have copies of our presentation, and it's also on the overhead. Perfunctory overview. Our mission statement is a straightforward one: to provide financial stewardship for the state of Oregon. Our constitutional authority comes from two articles, Article 6 and Articles 8. The former establishes the office of the state treasurer. The latter places the state treasurer on the state land board, along with the governor and the secretary of state. The legislative body has further given us statutory authority in five different areas: the investment management operations, cash management or banking operations, debt management operations, the Oregon College Savings Network, and public funds. And by public funds, we mean the protection and safekeeping of public funds deposited in private sector financial institutions. In terms of our presentation overview, we're going to start with our program priorities. We'll briefly allude to the reduction options, and then we'll get into the KPMs and wrap it up with conclusions. And of course, all along the way, we'll answer whatever questions you desire. First, in terms of program priorities, on slide 4, there's three main factors that we consider when we're trying to establish our priorities as an agency. The first is the financial impact of the program on state operations, taking into account the magnitude of dollars earned or saved for the state. The second factor is the number of customers and stakeholders served by a particular program, and finally, the impact to state agency, local government, and or non-government customers and stakeholders of program expansion, reduction, or elimination. With those three factors in mind, we've prioritized our five operations in the following manner. The investment program is priority number one. The cash management and banking program is number two, the debt management program, the college savings network, and the public funds collateralization programs follow in close pursuit. In terms of looking at each of the programs individually, starting with the investment program, I believe most of you are very familiar with this program. We manage over $89 billion in state assets, and we see these assets as a key component of Oregon's financial future. The Wilshire Trust Universe Comparison Service, and this is a third-party organization that we use to compare our performance to our peers and to other investment operations around the globe, found that the performance of the Oregon Pension Fund was among the best for public funds over the 1, 3, and 10-year periods, respectively. Our program manages investments in a variety of pools. Obviously, the nearly $70 billion Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund is the largest, but we also manage the Oregon Public, or excuse me, the State Accident Insurance Fund, the Common School Fund, the Higher Education Endowment Fund, and numerous other trust funds as well. The Treasury provides operational and staff support to the Oregon Investment Council. And while initially we provided both operational and staff support to the Oregon Growth Account Board, Business Oregon is slowly taking over those operations. We're in the process of transitioning to Business Oregon, as that is more of an economic development effort. At this point, there is still minimal input from the Treasury, aside from the fact that the state treasurer sits on that board. The investment program, like all of our operations, are self-supporting. In this case, it's fees associated with portfolio management activities. The 2015-17 governor's recommended budget for the investment operations is $23,054,583. It includes a POP package 101, the investment solutions package, that has an initial estimate of $6,011,273. What we're asking for is 18 positions for that POP plus 5 additional positions we did not get at the e-board for a total of approximately $7.5 million. Slide 6, the investment program prioritization considerations. The Oregon Investment Council and the Treasury, as you know, over the last several years have engaged numerous outside experts, industry experts, consultants, we've heard from auditors, to comprehensively analyze extensive operational deficiencies that have come to light since the global financial collapse in 2008. Package 101 addresses immediate needs in light of that analysis, while the Investment Modernization Act would implement a holistic best practices response, both to governance and resource issues. Those are encompassed in Senate Bill 134 and House Bill 2733. Oregon pays less for investment management services compared to its peers, about $182.5 million less over the last 5 years. This is according to an independent third-party analysis. What this basically means is we outsource a lot, but we have a very expensive model by virtue of the fact that we're outsourcing our operations. However, we're very good at negotiating the terms of those outsourced contracts, and as a result, we are, in fact, saving over what we would be expected to save had we not been as good at those negotiations according to this third-party analysis.
Sorry, Mr. Treasurer. Senator, what's it?
Thank you. Thank you for being, Mr. Treasurer. We're talking, I wanted to visit about the PERS Trust Fund. It appears to be doing nicely if we assume a 7.75% return on investment into the future in perpetuity. Virtually all private investment or retirement funds are calculated at around 4% plus or minus a quarter of a percent. So how comfortable are you with that 7.75% return on investment out in the future, and why are you comfortable if you are when it's twice what it is in the private sector?
Senator Whitsitt, Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, this is a decision that's made collectively by a number of people, including the Oregon Investment Council, of which I am a member, as well as the PERS Board, of which I'm obviously not a member. We are in the process of currently looking at our allocation and receiving estimates on what we think the long-term return opportunities are, and comparing that to what we currently assume, which is the 7.75. This is the time in that process where we bring all the data together to conclude whether or not that 7.75% is the right number or not the right number. And until I see the final analysis, I'm not going to comment on that because I want to see the analysis first. That said, I will tell you that the bigger issue from our perspective relating to our ability to manage at that level of risk is whether or not we're going to have the tools and the resources we need to be able to manage the risk. Going forward, the portfolio is going to continue to grow. It's going to continue to become more complex. We can't manage the size of the portfolio. We know it's going to continue to grow. So the only thing we really can manage is the complexity of that portfolio. So the bigger question for me is, are we going to get the tools and the resources we need to be able to manage the risk that we currently have in the portfolio? The answer to that question will go a long way towards giving me the ability to answer your question about how comfortable I am with that 7.75% assumed rate of return in the portfolio. I don't know if Mr. Bond or Mr. Sherbaum have additional comments on that.
I think the only thing I would add relative to the difference between what you see governments use and what corporates use is that there's different accounting structures and conventions. So in with government pension funds, when they're calculating the expected returns to calculate the future liabilities, they're allowed to use what an expected return, whereas as with under FASB for on the corporate side, it's a prescribed rate. So there's much more uniformity across it in corporate America, and that's a primary difference. And that is based on government bonds, and so that's the difference between the 4.5% and the what's typically you see now out in the market across. Mm-hmm. Across public funds is somewhere between 7.5 and 7.75.
And Mr. Bond, thank you, Ms. Jensen, for just running. Could you just identify yourself for the record?
Oh, sorry.
Thank you,
Darren
so much.
Bond, Deputy State Treasurer.
Thank you. Yes, certainly, Senator.
So the percentage, I mean, in order to get that 7.75% return, it requires a significantly higher degree of risk, and that higher degree of risk was really on display in 2008 when everything came tumbling down. When you're investing in REITs and all that sort of thing with the retirement money, there's some danger in that, which has been shown in 2002 and again in 2008. So I'm not asking a question, but I'd be very interested to hear what your analysis is. The other question is who's doing that analysis? I didn't hear you say that.
Senator Whitsitt, Chair Steiner, Hayward, members of the committee, there are a number of different organizations that are actually conducting that analysis. The Oregon Investment Council has its own consultants. The PERS board uses, is it Mercer? Milliman Associates to help with their analysis. You asked me my personal opinion, so I'm going to give you my personal opinion to the degree that I can, having not seen the analysis. As I look at, and again, this is not the OIC's opinion, this is my opinion, we have been in a low interest rate environment for a period of years now. And so that's made it very hard in our cash instruments to get a historic rate of return. As interest rates go up, obviously some of the bond portfolio and some of the fixed income instruments are going to be negatively impacted by increasing interest rates. On top of that, one of the biggest earners for us over the long term has been the private equity portion of our portfolio. We've gotten great returns. They have definitely provided the pension system with tremendous outsized performance in terms of long-term rates of return. That market is becoming more competitive, more crowded, and more expensive. And so the advice that the Oregon Investment Council has received has shown a declining long-term rate of return in that part of the market. So you are correct, Senator Whitsitt, in that if we are to keep up the historical rates of return that we've enjoyed up to this point, or to get somewhere in the ballpark of those returns, it's going to require us to continue to maintain a level of risk that will require us, again, to have the resources and the personnel and the tools to be able to manage that level of risk. And that's the genesis of the other asks that we've put in place in terms of Senate Bill 134 and House Bill 2733.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Oh, sorry, it's my presentation. I was all eager to hear what you had to say. The investment
I'll hang
program,
tight for the moment.
Continuing under the prioritization considerations, I won't go through all of these, but you can see the short and sort of the medium-term performance on the pension system, the state accident insurance fund, the common school fund. The key point for this slide, slide 7, is had the division performed at the median public fund peer level, the group of public funds that we're compared against, if we'd performed just at the median level over the last 5 years, the value in the pension system and the pension fund would be $3.5 billion less than it is today. So even though we are not resourced anything close to the median level, our performance up to this point, or at least the expectations of performance, have substantially outperformed that capacity. The cash management program. This is a fancy way of saying banking services. that we provide to state agencies and a number of local jurisdictions as well. We're responsible for oversight of all cash management functions of state agencies. That's a requirement of state statute. During calendar year 2014, we conducted more than 210 billion banking and investment transactions. That in and of itself makes the Treasury's cash management program a sizable banking operation at a regional level. It operates the Oregon Short-Term Fund, which includes both state agency and local government participants, and that fund has a value, as of the end of last year, of $14.4 billion. The Treasury provides operational and staff support to the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board, which provides strategic guidance and oversight of that fund. Revenues are derived primarily from banking service charges and the short-term fund investment management fees. So again, these are not general fund dollars that are used to support this program. The 2015 governor's recommended budget is $10,710,402, and that includes a placeholder related to Package 102 for the cash management business systems renewal project. During phase two, that placeholder number will be replaced by an actual number. Just to give you something of a tease, it'll be in the neighborhood of $4.5 million when that comes back to you in the phase two process. The cash management program, in terms of our prioritization considerations, the short-term fund is a cost-effective investment vehicle for state and local governments. It provides them significant cost savings. In fact, to purchase this service from the private sector would cost an estimated $15.2 million more in 2014. The centralized banking services, And I should probably just take one moment and talk about what that means. Centralized banking services means that all state agencies are banking with the state treasury. They are not banking through private sector banks. The checks that they write are actually drawn on the treasury. Our team determines the interest rates. And the net result is that centralized banking services run through the state treasury allows those agencies to mobilize dollars much faster than other states are allowed to mobilize their dollars. It also allows them to take advantage of significant cost advantage and enterprise pricing. It's estimated that in 2014, those agencies saved an estimated $5.9 million. That meant more dollars went into actual programming and outcomes for taxpayers rather than going towards the fees charged by private sector institutions. Local governments are significantly advantaged by this pool. If state agencies and the 1,186 local governments that participate in the pool had invested in 90-day T-bills instead, and that's the benchmark against which we compare our performance, their interest income for 2014 would have been $66.7 million less than what they actually received. When you combine the program savings for just 1 year of the cash management and the investment operations, the entire biennial current service level budget for the Oregon State Treasury would be exceeded by those cost savings.
Gotcha.
Senator, what's it?
Mr. Treasurer, could you tell us on the on that short-term fund, the Oregon Short-Term Fund, what was the average interest rate for 90-day Treasury bills, and what was the average performance of the fund?
I think the average... Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer, Madam Chair, Senator Witzig. I think the average for 90-day T-bills was around 0.03%. And for the short-term fund is about 0.5. We're paying 0.5. And paid for 0.5 or just slightly over that during the course of the year.
Thank you.
Slide 10, the debt management program. It centrally coordinates the issuance of all state agency and authority bonds for Oregon. Gross long-term debt outstanding, exclusive of conduit revenue bonds, for example, those run through the Oregon Facilities Authorities, totaled approximately $10.7 billion as of June 30, 2014. The Treasury is liaison to three bond rating agencies, Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's.
Yes.
And we provide operational and staff support to a number of different commissions, including the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, the Private Activities Bond Committee, and the Oregon Facilities Authority. Once again, revenues are derived from bond issuance, tracking and reporting fees paid by state agencies and local governments. The governor's 2015-17 recommended budget is $3,775,273, includes $1.1 million related to POP 103, coordination of the higher education debt issuance. Some of the prioritization considerations on slide 11, debt management professionals have the knowledge and experience to identify and take advantage of opportunities for Oregon and its taxpayers. For example, the refunding of ODOT, lottery, and general obligation bonds during 2015 alone will save the state $121 million in interest costs over the life of those bonds. With the continued support of the Oregon legislature, the debt management program issues 11 QGO bonds as an alternative to certificates of participation. Again, that saves money for the state of Oregon. The debt management division efforts in this front have produced $80 million in cash flow savings from the conversion of those COPs to general obligation bonds since 2010 when the program was instituted. Oregon has maintained a superior general obligation bond rating of AA plus and AA1 over the past several years, and this is at a time when many states and local and municipal governments have seen their bond ratings actually deteriorate due to ongoing financial and economic challenges. Long story short, the better the bond rating, the farther your tax dollars go towards supporting infrastructure investments, including those we talked about, Representative Comp and Chair Steiner Hayward, related to higher education. The Oregon 529 College Savings Network. The Oregon 529 College Savings Network provides a very valuable opportunity for Oregonians to save over the long term for higher education. It also enables Oregon citizens to take advantage of substantial state and federal tax savings. It provides more flexibility than other college savings tools to boot. Changes in program managers, new investment options, increased oversight and accountability have all renewed public confidence in this 12-year-old program. The network continues to grow. In 2010, the total value is about $1 billion. At the end of 2014, it was about $2.28 billion with approximately 150,000 accounts. Again, revenues are derived from account administrative fees and payments from plan providers for network promotional activities. The governor's recommended budget for 2015-17 is $5,287,418.
Mr. Treasurer, as you know, this is an area of some interest of mine, and I've been meeting with Mr. Valley and others from the savings plan about outreach, because I am concerned that historically it's people of higher socioeconomic status who are taking advantage of this, when in fact it's lower income Oregonians who are having the most trouble affording higher education. And at some point, I don't think you can go into some detail now if you want, or you can just send this committee a note, but I think it would be helpful to other members of the committee to outline some of the activities of the College Savings Plan to help people understand what your office is doing to make this available and make people in lower income communities more aware of the opportunities that are available to them to save for their children's education. I think it's a really important point.
Yeah, very good. Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, we're in luck because Michael Parker, who is the head of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network, is in the room, and I'm sure he's absolutely brimming with excitement at answering that question, because there is a lot going on and it's a very important question that we need to address.
Thank you. Mr. Parker, I apologize. I had total name freeze. I saw you sitting in the back of the room. So, Mr. Parker, welcome, please.
Thank you, Chair Steiner Haywood, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the 529 College Savings Network. We, too, share the same thoughts about making sure this is available to all Oregonians. One thing we make sure we do is make sure that the threshold to be involved is very low. $25 to get started is one piece that makes it really easy to get started. The second thing that we do is we're going to every community in the state. We just launched, you mentioned John Bally's name, we just hired an outreach director that you gave us the funding for back in last year. We're launching an outreach program to actually get boots on the ground in every single community. So we're reaching out not just, you know, a TV and radio campaign, but actually getting on the ground in every community around the state to let folks know about this opportunity. And we're launching a new program here in September called Be College Ready, which is going to allow us to actually interface with elementary schools everywhere around the state. It's a pilot program, but we're hoping to expand it. So again, not just doing that regular media campaign, but actually getting in those communities and talking with parents of all means, in addition to talking to parents with the Hispanic community, making sure they understand that they have options as well.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Senator Woodsett.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's very important work. I think we should probably also strive to keep contact with the middle-class Oregonians who many times do not have access to Pell Grants and other help that the lower socioeconomic group have, and that this 529 program was essentially set up to help them. And instead of going to the government for help, it's an opportunity to save for yourself, so you don't have to go to the government for help.
Senator Woodsett, that's exactly correct. We try to appeal to everyone. We've built a program that actually has investment options at all risk levels, but our goal is do not leave anyone out. Make sure we communicate with everyone regardless of their economic status.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Treasurer Wheeler.
Thanks, Michael. Continuing on slide 13, in terms of prioritization considerations for the 529 College Savings Network, not a penny of Oregon tax dollars are used to support this program. The operations are entirely supported from participant fees and program manager contributions. The program continues to get good honors. There's a program out there called savingforcollege.com, which is a highly respected and widely utilized source of information on college savings options. It receives their highest five CAPS acknowledgement. The network also has done a good job of keeping costs down. In 2011, we actually cut the administrative fees in half from 0.1% down to 0.05%, 10 basis points down to 5. Slide 14, public funds collateralization program.
Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I was spacing out here. Mr. Treasurer, on the previous slide, you said that the new investment options and a reduction in fees have renewed public confidence in the 12-year program. I'm sure that's true. Could you give us some specific examples of what you've done to keep from having another 2008 debacle?
Senator Woodsett, Chair Steiner, Hayward, members of the committee, and Michael may add to this after I'm done butchering his good work. But one of the most important contributions that I think the board made to this program was putting in place a firm that actually looks over the shoulders of both the board members as well as the plan providers, TIA, CRAF, and MFS, as they do their as they conduct their operations and make presentations to the board and provide products and information back and forth. So essentially we brought in a firm that is there specifically for accountability and oversight on an ongoing basis. And in my opinion, that was probably the most significant thing we did in terms of instilling confidence, but also longer term, once we had new investment options and new providers, we had to wait a number of years. I believe it was 3 years. 3 years before we could actually get the rankings based on our costs, based on our accountability, based on the options that we provided, based on the returns in the program. We've received very, very good accolades from those who watch and follow these programs in the universe of college savings options that are available. And I don't know if there's something significant I've forgotten. Michael says, good to go.
Thank you. I think the only thing I would add to that is at that period of time, Treasury kind of made a strategic change in how it was managed. It had been managed out of the front office. It didn't have, I wouldn't say it had the same rigor of administrative oversight that we use for the other operating programs. It was moved into the business part of Treasury, And we looked at the way we manage the investment program, realizing this was an investment program, and we've subjected it to the same kind of rigor. It has much more oversight from our internal audit function, as well as copying the structure that Ted has discussed with oversight from a third-party consultant. And it's been very successful for the program.
Page 14, slide 14, the Public Funds Collateralization Program, the overview. This, as I mentioned up front, this is the program that protects public funds at financial institutions. Protections of these funds is obviously in the best interest of every Oregonian. As of December 31st, 2014, there are 33 community banks and 13 credit unions participating in the program. The public funds currently held by banks is in excess of $2.7 billion. The public funds held by credit unions is in excess of $46.5 million. The pledged collateral by banks is $1.6 billion. The pledged collateral by credit unions is $70.9 million. And again, revenues are derived from collateral pool charges to participating banks and credit unions. The governor's recommended budget for 2015 to 2017 is $526,476. Slide 15, prioritization considerations for the Public Funds Collateralization Program. Again, not a penny of Oregon taxpayer funds are used for this program. That's something that I like to point out. The Public Funds Collateralization Program operates entirely from payments of participating financial institutions. As I mentioned, there's now 33 banks, and there are 1,500 local government customers who would otherwise need to contract for these services on an individual basis. On April 1st, 2013, local government financial services expanded with the addition of 10 credit unions. That number is now up to 13 credit unions. Currently, the credit unions are actually over-collateralized in anticipation of taking on more public funds in the near future. Treasury charges are designed to recover only the cost of operating this program. So the Treasury doesn't make any profit. There's no profit margin built into the rates that we charge. Financial institutions, therefore, would pay more if this program were eliminated. Slide 16 is what I like to call the money shot, adding up the savings. Basically, if you glance at that, what it's really saying is we save taxpayers $1.61 for every dollar we spent.
I like that number.
And that doesn't include debt management savings. Those are our ongoing. It's hard because debt management does like this. That's our ongoing average savings.
The Oregon challenges and improvements, as we mentioned, the Oregon Investment Council governance and operations improvements that are encompassed in Senate Bill 134 and House Bill 2733, we see as a top priority for the OIC, the Oregon Investment Council, and the Treasury. The cash management replacement of systems and processes, and the information security program enhancement. We see these as both important challenges and improvements that need to be made in the Treasury operations in the near term.
And I should just say to members of the committee, this is the second time you've heard reference to those two bills, and we will be talking about them and their implications and how this committee might be involved with addressing some of the concerns raised by those bills in phase two. So you should feel free to keep mentioning them, Mr. Treasurer, but since it's the second time they came up, I thought the committee would appreciate understanding where they fit in this whole conversation.
Thank you, Chair Steiner Hayward. The agency budget reduction options, I don't think I'll take your time to go through all of these in detail, but on slides 18, we have the 5% elimination options. On slide 19, we have the 10% elimination options. Moving to the KPMs on slide 20, obviously performance-based budgeting is vital to guide the efficient deployment of our Treasury resources. As a data-driven organization, the Treasury is continually evaluating the most cost-effective manner to structure service delivery. As the state's centralized provider for investment and banking services, the Treasury looks for ways to leverage buying power from large dollars under management and the number of transactions that are involved to keep the costs as low as possible, thus freeing up the maximum amount of funds for program use. Banking service charges are consistently lower than those that are available on a direct basis, and investment management costs for our internally managed short-term fund, the OSTF, remain lower than competing private market funds with a similar investment objective. That last bullet point is simply a statement that for those funds that are managed in-house, we are actually extremely competitive, in fact, more so than private sector options. KPM number one, the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund net performance of the five-year rolling average compared to the policy benchmark. Basically, as you can see, if you're looking at the dots, in virtually all cases, we exceed those benchmarks net of fees. KPM2, Common School Fund net performance of the five-year rolling average compared to the policy benchmark. And again, the fund's rolling five-year investment performance exceeds its policy benchmark by 0.57% net of fees. KPM number three, the Oregon short-term fund returns compared to benchmark. And I guess this also, Chair Steiner-Hedward, gets to Senator Whitsitt's program question to some degree. In 2014, the OSTF investment performance exceeded the fund's benchmark, which was the rolling 91-day T-bill returns, while the fund's five-year annualized return outperformed that same benchmark by 0.67% or 67 basis points for the period ended December 31st, 2014. KPM number four, the expense to assets ratio for the Oregon short-term fund. As you can see, the expense in 2014, the annual expense ratios for over 190 institutional money market mutual funds ranged from 0.06 to 0.27% with an average of 0.18%. Our expense ratio was 0.06%, so very favorable compared to those other 190 institutional money market mutual funds. Cash management performance, again, the news is good. Over the last 10 years, participation has grown from 69% of all Oregon local governments to 79%, with small gains reflected in each year. So there's a consistent upward trend of participation, which we like to see. KPM number six, the banking services, the average cost per transaction. This is one where we hit the ball out of the park. We're basically, our average cost per transaction is 40% of the target. So we feel very good about that. That's largely due to the good work of the Treasury employees. They are very good negotiators, and as a result, they get us well below the targets on cost. And they pride themselves on that, which I like. KPM number seven, the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Program for bonds outstanding. I should just state flat out, we don't really have a reliable benchmark for this. It's our opinion that this is not really a particularly robust KPM for us, but as you can see, the program remains essentially stable.
Mr. Treasurer, does that mean that you would prefer to substitute some other KPM for this one that would be more relevant to your work? You can consider that question and get back to us if you don't have an instant answer for it. We always encourage agencies to consider whether there are better KPMs.
Sure, Madam Chair. Historically, the legislature, when this came in, wanted to see the activity relative to this. We just don't know what to measure it against. There's really no other program like it. We don't market it. You know, they come to us and it happens. So we'd be happy to take some input on whether or not you even want us to include this.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, Mr. Bond, is that if there's nothing useful to compare it against, then it's not a very useful KPM, as you quite rightly point out. And just because something's been a KPM in the past doesn't mean it has to continue. We see changes. We saw a lot of changes in the last biennium under Co-Chair Smith and myself, and we've seen some more already this biennium for agency budgets that we've already passed. And so we want KPMs to be relevant and useful and actually reflect the kinds of things that we think are important in terms of how our government functions to serve our citizens. So if you guys have too many KPMs, make a case and we'll just dump this one. If you think that the total number of KPMs is reasonable, but this isn't a good one, suggest something you think is more relevant and better reflects the needs of Oregonians, and we'll be happy to consider replacing it. That's all I'm saying.
Great. Thank you, Chair Steiner Hayward. We appreciate that. We will look into it. And we just didn't want to snow you on this. It's not a good KPM, and I don't want to paint a narrative.
That's exactly what we expect. We've heard that from agencies before about other KPMs, and that's exactly what we want to hear about these things. So thank you. We appreciate it.
Good. All right. KPM number 8, the number of 529 College Savings Network accounts. The program obviously continues to grow at a steady pace, and the expectation based on the program's recent gains is for continued growth in the 2015-17 biennium.
Mr. Treasurer, I would say, and I've had some conversations with Mr. Parker about this, I'm probably going to suggest, and I'll want your team's input on this, changing that KPM a little bit. I want it to grow in terms of how many people participate and the number of accounts, but I think it's much more interesting to know what percentage of children under a certain age actually have 529 set up for them, especially in low and middle income families where the need is probably higher. So I'd love to visit some more with your team about a more appropriate KPM, because the number, it's still, I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
But I think we're proposing changing it like you're talking about.
Perfect. That's great.
Thank you. Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, on slide 29, I think we've pretty accurately captured your concern, which we absolutely share. So under KPM 9, we said OST proposes changing this measure to the participation rate of minors, those under the age of 25 in each county, and proposes a target that doubles the participation rate of each county in 5 years. We think it's more of an actionable KPM that'll help us better manage the program. But if there's other suggestions or ideas on how we might refine that KPM, we're certainly interested and open to it. But we share your basic concern.
Lovely. Thank you.
The additional resources that John Valley and Outreach, that this allows us to have a KPM like that, because then it gives us actionable information that we can attack.
Thank you. I'm very interested in that proposition. I think it's much more relevant than the actual number of accounts. We have more babies born every year, so in theory, we should have more accounts every year, but that doesn't really matter. It matters about how many kids are being served. So thanks.
KPM number 10 is really as much a reflection of the fiscal discipline of the legislature as it is the good management of the debt management division. That's Oregon debt issuance activity, the levels of volume, and total state and local government debt outstanding by fiscal year. If you look at it, what you can see is state debt has actually decreased over the last 4 years. That is the legislature and the governor taking to heart what the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission has advised. Last session, you didn't even issue up to the self-imposed cap during the last biennium. So the legislature continues to show, I think, smart fiscal discipline when it comes to the issuance of debt.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Mr. Treasurer, does that state and local outstanding debt, does that include ODOT debt?
I believe it does.
Laura.
Senator Whitsitt, Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, we'll get back to you on that. I believe it does, but I want to confirm that, and Laura couldn't be here today to confirm it, so I will confirm that with
you.
Okay,
very good. And one other follow-up, but does it also include guaranteed loans?
As in the school bond guarantee?
Yeah.
No, that number's not in there.
Okay.
Senator Whitsitt, Chair Steiner here, we will get back to you on the previous question as
well.
Thank you.
KPM 11, customer service. At Treasury, we obviously strive very hard to provide good to excellent customer service. Our ratings are consistently high, as you can see from where the red dots are, and we're always working to improve.
And Senator Whitsitt, by the way, I just did the math in my head and caught up with the conversation. It does include ODOT's debt.
It does.
Yes.
Okay.
So going back to 11 again, or going forward to 11, depending on which direction we're talking, you got 2012 numbers on there. Do you have more recent data?
We don't. We don't. We have big projects going on addressing exactly these. We have had very consistent numbers, and it was a matter of reallocating resources or trying to tackle these problems, and we elected to just tackle these problems.
That's fine. I was just curious because I noticed the discrepancy. That's all. It's not a big deal. I was just curious.
It was a judgment call we made, and that's how we made it.
I would always vote to improve service rather than measure it. So thank you.
And that's our formal presentation. Chair Steiner Hedward, members of the committee.
Questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. You went over the 5% and 10% reductions pretty quickly. Since you have no general fund, and you have no lottery funding, and you have no federal funding, and you manage $90 billion in all the state banking, and all the trades you generated funding, actually you generate yourself, this is a really big softball, but why should the Treasury be subjected to a across-the-board 5 to 10% cut?
Senator Whitsitt, Chair Steiner Hayward, and members of the committee, we should not be. And the reason for that, to be quite blunt, is these programs operate in complete isolation to what's going on politically inside the building or what's happening with the rest of the state budget. And our programs are completely self-supporting. In fact, as I mentioned up front, the dollars we spend in these programs actually saves taxpayers and programs dollars through savings. And so if I were looking at how to manage the state's budget, I would not support an across-the-board cut. I would look at actually where are you leveraging your limited public resources. And the Treasury, in my opinion, and I can't speak for other agencies because I'm not as knowledgeable, is an excellent deployment of limited resources because our dollars save money. And in essence, we are helping leverage and subsidize other areas of the state budget, whether it's education or whether it's local government, other areas like public safety.
Madam Chair, I firmly believe that the legislature needs oversight of the Treasury and that kind of money. But the idea of actually during stressful times, you need arguably more staff to make sure what you're doing the right things, not being cut at the same time. So that's my softball for the day.
Thank you, Senator Whitsitt. I appreciate it. My team does, too. Thank you, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. Anything else for these folks? Thank you, Treasurer Wheeler, Mr. Bond, Mr. Parker, and others for the work you put into preparing this and for answering all our questions. Senator Johnson, we are done with the formal presentation. Do you have any other questions for the Treasury team?
I guess I apologize.
That's
right. We're at that point in this session where there's as much going on in the room as out in the hall. I guess the thing that I'm the most interested in is hearing more about the policy proposals. I think they have a profound effect on the budget and ergo are germane to discussion in this committee. My concern is to, in phase two, be prepared, all of us be prepared to have that conversation. I just think there's a lot of moving parts, and it strikes me that the downside could be significant, and it's worthy of, I think, expanded conversation.
And actually, great lines we're thinking like, because we mentioned exactly that happening. So we're totally on track with you, Senator.
We'll be ready.
So.
Cool.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, Chair Steiner Hayward. We will be ready for that in phase two, and we appreciate it.
Yeah. The only other question that I have is I can't tell you how many meetings I've sat in as we're beginning to think about the budget, and the Ways and Means have just come back from Ways and Means on the road. So we heard throughout the geographic reach of Oregon a litany of requests, and so many of them come back to bonding. And at some point, knowing where the prudent man terminus to our ability to bond is with clarity would be helpful. You can get as many different opinions as people you ask. And I think this constant default position to just issue bonds, I don't know, as the sort of steward of the public pocketbook, where you get to a point that says prudence dictates not bonding beyond this point. And I'm quite interested in knowing your opinion on that.
Senator Johnson, Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, I am very comfortable with the constraints that the legislature has adopted around bond issuance. We currently have a self-imposed limit of 5% on general obligation bonds, meaning no more than 5% of the state's general fund shall go towards servicing general obligation bonds. I think that is a prudent standard. It's been validated by the credit rating agencies year after year as being a very prudent standard, and it's a standard, more importantly, that the legislature and governors have abided by. And as a result of abiding by that general obligation standard, we have earned credit rating upgrades at a time when other states that were issuing debt like crazy without the same level of discipline were seeing their credit ratings plummet, meaning our purchasing power was going up while their purchasing power was declining. We have similar standards in place around lottery bonding. It's a slightly different standard. It's a 4-to-1 standard, meaning that we will have reserves at 25% for bonds issued under the lottery program. Again, that's been upheld as a prudent standard, and in fact, we get AAA bond ratings for lottery-backed issuances. So we think, and it is my opinion as state treasurer, that those are the correct and prudent standards, and we should continue to abide by those standards.
Thank you. And please, with your indulgence, one other question that I have, and I have talked with your staff a little bit about this. There seems to be a fair amount of buzz in the building about the triple P, the public-private partnerships, and you and I talked about this on the telephone. I would welcome some greater exploration of what are the deliverables out of that contract. Have they been delivered? One of the reasons I was popping in and out of this hearing is that next door, bonding requests for four courthouses are being discussed, including the Multnomah County Courthouse. And I understand that that 3P methodology has been abandoned for the Multnomah County Courthouse because of the excessive costs. And I'm trying to figure out what motivates that conclusion. What are we doing exploring continued 3P opportunities if a major construction project estimated just moments ago in the range of between $250 and $260 million, if that's an unacceptable candidate given the cost drivers, what are the acceptable candidates? And are we working really hard to put a square peg in a round hole? What are we doing?
Correct. And Senator Johnson, through Chair Steiner Hayward, is there a particular forum or forum you would like that conversation?
Actually, phase two would be very helpful, Mr. Treasurer. Since you don't have boatloads of policy option packages, we'll have time, I think, to talk about the two bills that you've been referencing and that we're all interested in hearing a little bit more about, and those in the context of your policy option packages, and then a little bit more about this public-private partnership, because I do think this committee's interested. Does that sound reasonable, Senator?
It sounds very reasonable. I understand that there was some kind of a report generated and as a deliverable, and if in fact that's the case, could you make that available to the professional staff and the professional staff make it available to the committee?
Senator Johnson, Chair Steiner Hayward, we will absolutely provide that information forthwith, and we will be ready in phase two to discuss this in greater detail.
Thank you very much.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. I want to talk just a little about the ODOT debt and the budget. In the current biennium, we have about $2.1 billion in highway funding, and that is a mixture of actual current revenues from gas taxes, weight per mile, and so forth, and JTA bonded money. And it's difficult to just to break those apart. But we know that the JTA money is going to run out in about 2 years. And so we're going to have somewhere between a $600 and $650 million biennial debt service on a cash flow of considerably less than $2.1 billion. They have 2,500 employees, which is about a $500 million payroll. I would really like in the next phase to have your analysis of where we're going, because we have the 6 cent gas tax that was imposed with the JTA is tied up for 25 years on revenue bonds, most of it, in addition to the licensing and all that sort of thing. I see this agency sailing off a cliff in a couple of years, and I would really like your analysis of that.
Yes, sir. Senator Whitsitt, Chair Steiner here, will be prepared in phase two to bring a presentation on that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. We are open for public testimony today, but nobody signed up. Is there anybody in the room who did not sign up who would like to testify on the budget for the Treasury of the State? Okay. If not, I am going to close the hearing on House Bill 5041. Is there any other business before the committee today? Okay. Mr. Borden, what's the rest of our week look like? Could you remind the committee, please?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, you'll have the Department of Revenue for the next 2 days, phase two on Tuesday and collections on Wednesday. And then you will pick up the work sessions that had to be canceled last Thursday for this Thursday. So.
Great. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, in anticipation of hearing the tax practitioner's budget, I have been asking about private outside contracting, and I got a response back from them that they have a contract that had not yet been consummated, but it was a time and materials contract.
Really?
And I think that that is something that needs to be explored. I don't know if they have issued that, but any agency listing a time and materials contract in the wake of the Cover Oregon debacle, I think that's a role for the legislature to probe a little bit deeper.
You have my unconditional support for that request, Senator Johnson. I will speak with professional staff about that forthwith and get back to you. Cool. I appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Mr. Borden, anything else? Okay, we stand adjourned. Mr. Borden, anything else?